is. They used every penny of their life savings to fund it. She worries about being able to make it financially, or at least breaking even. This is something I wanted to do, but I've had to second-guess my decision so many times. One night, after hours, something happened that convinced Marion she was doing the right thing. Something hard to put into words. One evening, I finally got my mother into bed. She does not sleep much, does not sit down much. She is constantly on the move. I knelt beside her bed to pray with her. Then I went into Helen's room to ask her if I could pray with her, and I did. Another resident, Angela, had been particularly agitated that day, opening and closing doors, holding imaginary conversations with her kittens and people from her past, obsessively wiping away non-existent spots in the bathroom sink. Marion spent a little extra time with her that night to reassure and console her. One by one, she did the same with each of the other residents. I just talked with each of them, listening to their needs, talking with them about their feelings, about eternal things. I left the last room and started down the hall. The only light was from the little nightlights that flicker in the hallways. I had the most beautiful feeling of peace and comfort that I have ever experienced in my life. It was as if there were warm arms encircling the entire building. Marion called her husband right away. I phoned him and said to him, "Whatever happens, it's worth it. If we have to close the doors in a week, this one experience has been worth all of that." And she continues to have those feelings that it was meant to be, and that it is a wonderful venture. I also hate it a lot of times because it is such a worry. And there are those days, just like raising small children, that are so exhausting. But the bottom line is that it was a great thing to do, and I'm glad we did it. Writing set the wheels in motion. Although she was astonished at the way things unfolded, Marion was not surprised that writing it down was part of the process that set the wheels in motion. She sums it up by saying that when you write something down, you begin to define what you know, and, therefore, what you want. You can't have what you want until you know what it is. Writing clarifies what it is that you are asking for. God can give you what you want, says Marion, but you have to be clear on what you want. And writing opened her up to the news that the first step would have to come from her. Marion used her journal as a place to collect the signs or signals that things were going well, that this was meant to be. That gave her the courage to act, knowing that if she took the risk, the backing would be there. That's another benefit of writing. It helps me to recognize what is happening and to appreciate it. When I don't write it down, sometimes I overlook those small victories and forget to be grateful. Writing gave her the courage to act. Prophetic pages. In the light of her remarkable achievement, it sends a chill down my spine to now read this description in Marion's journal pages, written over 2 years before her son-in-law approached her. What I'd like to find is a small home-like facility where the staff could mingle with, eat with, as well as care for the elderly, as if they were beloved parents and grandparents. The decor would be light and bright, colorful and warm, reminding the residents of their best-remembered days when they were young and productive. A place where memories are listened to, cherished, maybe recorded. Where mealtimes are presided over by someone who encourages conversation and interaction and laughter. Where disabilities are minimized and abilities strengthened. A place where caregivers are more than employees, but are people filled with compassion and love, and the knowledge that their personal lives will be blessed because of the care they give to those who need them so much. They will be people who willingly serve, knowing that their own old age needs will be graciously attended, and that when they enter into the world where we are ageless, they will be greeted and thanked by all those whom they helped. Perhaps I am senile and delusional myself to have such a wish. Far from delusional, Marion expressed in her writing something her head did not yet know, but her heart knew deeply. In her longing, She anticipated the reality before it happened. And unwittingly, she also projected her own part in the undertaking. Almost 4 years before opening Beehive Home, Marion had written another prophetic entry in her journal notebook. What is the best use of my life now? What is the highest good? I have asked myself that question since I was a youth, and the answer is not forthcoming. At one time, I thought I would do some remarkable deed that would benefit mankind and put my name in the history books. I soon outgrew that self-serving notion. I know whatever my work is will involve serving others, and that the reward will be the quiet peace that accompanies such work. Wells, Nevada, population 1,000. One small store, grocery and drugstore combined. There is something else there now, too. A state-of-the-art nursing home with a hug around it. Now you. Next time you are writing out a description of the perfect achievement of your plan, go one step further and answer in writing the questions, where do I fit into the equation? What do I need to do to help make this happen? Listen closely to the conversations around you. Collect the signs and signals that might be challenging you to take the initiative. It's not a magic feather. It's you who can fly. 15. Writing letters to God. The Middle Eastern expression, from your lips to God's ears, means, may God hear your prayer. I say, from your pen to God's ears. And why not? Praying on paper is a way of acknowledging God's presence in your life, asking for help, and giving thanks. Taped into one of my journals is a cocktail napkin from United Airlines with a phrase scribbled across it. It was the nearest thing to write on when I was in the friendly skies, watching the in-flight movie The Wedding Singer. It is a sweet movie, but I wasn't paying too much attention to it until I heard this line sung in the background as the hero bemoans the loss of his sweetheart. I don't believe in an interventionist God. Maybe he didn't believe, but God intervened anyway. He got the girl he longed to marry. I do believe in an interventionist God, a God who cares for me personally. Sometimes it seems kind of silly. Surely the Almighty has more pressing things on his agenda than your lost notebook, I tell myself. There are wars and famine and terrorist bombings and people in serious pain, emotional and physical. Where in heaven does a letter like this go? Dear God, please help me find my missing journal. It has a lot of important stuff in it. It is somewhere in your world. Did I leave it at a coffee shop? Wouldn't they call me? Or did they just toss it in a drawer waiting for me to ask? God, please help. You know where it is. There must be a lost and found department in heaven. Or maybe God gives the assignment over to a lower level agent. I don't know. All I do know is that when I write letters to God, no matter how mundane they are, God answers his mail. Letting the pen respond. Sometimes the answer comes through in my writing as a dialogue. I usually write to God at night before going to bed, and then, first thing in the morning, while I am only half awake, I write out both sides of a conversation going on inside my sleepy head. I write down the words as fast as they come to me, without stopping to edit or analyze. I repeat the query from the night before. Often I am startled by the directness of the response. God, where is the letter from the program director? It is inside a bag, the black canvas bag under the desk. Sometimes the reply is not what I want or expect, but there is always kindness and caring in it, like a loving parent, supportive but admonishing. Is my journal in the car trunk with my laptop? No, it is not. I want you to finish writing this book. I will make that easy and flowing for you. Do not let anything stand in the way, not anything. Let go of finding the journal. Let go of wondering and worrying. Go to Vivace's and write. You can do it, and it will flow as soon as you give it the time. That's all that is needed. You will find what is missing after you reclaim, rediscover your own powers. All you need is within. Just right. Any chance I could find the floppy disk? I know I entered so much on there. It will come to you. Don't waste time looking. I did as I was told. I went back to my writing. To my delight, both the disk and the journal did show up in the next few days. Is it your own subconscious answering? When you pose a question at night and get an answer in the morning, the doubter will say it is your own subconscious answering. That may be true, but then, too, maybe it is God leading you to the part of your subconscious that has the answer. Before I dismiss the answers I get as simply my own imagination, I recall a dramatic incident that happened several years ago. I was scheduled to give a presentation to a large group of over 400 people out of state. The sponsors had invited me to sell my books and any tapes I might have in the back of the room. They would even provide assistance to help me manage the money. This was a great boon, but at the time I had no audio tape to sell. Then I remembered a program I had done 8 years earlier, which had been taped. I realized the message of that tape would be perfect for this audience, but I only had 1 week to find it, duplicate it, and package it. I had searched the family room, where we kept racks and racks of old motivational tapes and sales tapes, and even some tapes of radio interviews or other programs I had done, none of which seemed right. I knew which tape I wanted, but I didn't have a clue where that tape could be. I only knew that it existed. I was feeling rather desperate, perhaps more so because I was worried about money. If I could find this tape, it would help me. Dear God, I need to find the audio tape to copy for sale at the convention this weekend. Please tell me in writing tomorrow morning where to find it, directly. No time to waste. And also, could you wake me up in time, feeling refreshed, even though I am going to bed so late tonight? Thank you for my friends and my family who are like the Rock of Gibraltar in my life. Next morning, early, I pulled my journal into bed with me. I was still groggy, but I cut right to the chase. Okay, God, so where is the audio tape? In the attic. Huh? Not in the family room where all the tapes are? In the attic. I don't have any time to waste. I need it right now. The attic is a big place. Where in the attic? I was getting annoyed. I was still sure it was in the family room, and I was being sent on a wild goose chase. Look to the left. Come on, what do I look for? A shoebox inside a bigger box. On the left, middle. Still doubting and in my pajamas, I went into the hallway and pulled down the spring ladder to the attic. I crawled up the steps, went on my knees along the left, and there was a big box that I had not noticed before. I looked inside and found a shoebox of old tapes, among them the tape I was looking for and needed. This helpful message from God was particularly powerful to me for several reasons. For one, I was at a low ebb in my life, and it reminded me that God cares. For another, I was able to duplicate that tape and sell over 200 copies in the next 2 weeks. The income I received helped sustain me through a tough time. Most significantly, I still haven't figured this part out, this answer belied my own cynicism that the answers from God are just me in an alpha state. I was not the one who had put that tape in the shoebox in the attic, and I had no way of knowing it was there. No way except one way. Getting answers indirectly. If your letter is a petition, the answer does not always come through the next morning's writing. But if you have asked for it in prayer writing, the return is forthcoming. Years ago, my daughter Emily found in her travels and gave me a gift of a small pamphlet of about 2 dozen pages that intrigued me. It was published in the 1920s and had a quaint way of using exclamation points and italics. There was much wisdom between the lines. I remember that the author had made some succinct points about the power of writing down what you want. For the life of me, I could not recall where this book came from or how to locate another. I called several bookstores, but it was too tiny to be included in books in print, so they could not order it. Since it was so old, there was a good chance it was out of print anyway. I was not sure of the author's name, but the title was hard to forget. The publishers claimed the title came from an early response to the formula of the manuscript, "It works." When all other avenues failed, I wrote a letter to God, mentioning the book by name, and then leaving it in God's hands. I was confident that if locating that little book were important to my work, God would figure out a way to get me a copy. As it turned out, it was what my cousin Larry calls a Zen find, that is, a totally unexpected, perfect fit connection, like finding a song you have been searching for in a bin at a used record store. 2 weeks after I penned my request to God, a friend lent me an odd book, self-published in 1972, about how to win any contest you enter. Plunked down in the middle of the text on a certain page, with no transition and no lead, seemingly as an afterthought, was a reference to "It Works," including ordering information. I almost fell out of my chair. For the author of the contest book to mention this slight 70-year-old pamphlet was one thing, but to tell how to send away for it was pure serendipity. Within the week, I had the copy I needed. My young friend Charlotte writes letters to God all the time, without expecting a written response. Charlotte is a neighbor of mine, a 16-year-old high school student. One day, she heard me talking to her mother about letters to God. Shyly, she showed me some letters she herself had written, not only to God, but to a whole chorus of protectors. I was touched when Charlotte told me I could share these letters. They have a depth in them I found both remarkable and stirring. In their innocence and beauty, they gently underscore the fact that prayer is like a conversation with a trusted, wiser friend. Dear God, well, I call you today for extra assistance in the many things that are occurring in my life. There is no order of importance. I first ask you to help me become completely fit. That would entail losing a lot of weight and becoming a healthy eater as well as a regular exerciser. I know that it is in my possibility range. I could just use some help and motivation. I thank you for your assistance in the weight I have already lost. Second, you know Deli Boy who works in the grocery store? I know you know his name, but that has not yet been for my discovery. I would ask that you help make him a reality for me. Out of all of my boys that I flirt with and whatnot, I have the most healthy feeling about him. Please don't make this one a disappointment. Third, I ask you to help me prepare fully for finals that are creeping up on me. Help me to stay focused and succeed on doing very well on my exams and on my everyday schoolwork. I next ask you for the best possible summer job. Lastly, I ask for your assistance in my new leadership position at school. Help me to succeed and not stray. Help me to stay involved with others, but have a job and a life at the same time. Thank you for listening to my prayer, and I know it is a lot to ask, but I know the best will always work out for me. It is now 11:05, and since I have to get up at 6 a.m. tomorrow, I am going to say goodnight. Love always and forever, Charlotte Jean. Charlotte did not expect a direct answer, but she was confident her prayers were heard. A letter written several months later shows that her unblinking faith did not go unrewarded. Dear God, Jesus, Mary, and my guardian angels, how are you? Well, while you're off making a difference in people's lives and environments, I want to thank you for the difference you've made in mine. I was just looking back on my previous journal entries, and wow, it is amazing the difference you have made. I had a great summer. I went on 2 great retreats with my youth group, and my typing job kept me flexible. Plus, I improved my typing skills, something I thought was impossible. Who'd have thunk? Also, to think I once called Brian Deli Boy. We are now friends, and he likes me for who I am, and I can definitely live with that, though more would never hurt. Hint, hint. Also, I am doing great in school, even with my busy schedule. I am so blessed. I have a life, and I'm doing well and keeping up. Well, if it is not too much hassle, I could still use a hand in losing weight. But at least I'm not self-conscious about it anymore. Well, anyway, I love you tons, and thanks. Charlotte Jean. Giving thanks and praise. The letters Charlotte shared with me were also a reminder that prayer is not just supplication, but praise and thanksgiving. Not all letters to God are pleas for help. I'd just like to take a moment to thank God, Jesus, the saints, Mary, and my angels for getting me through a tough time in my life, for making it a spiritually strengthening experience, for always being there and listening to my prayers, for walking with me wherever I go, and for holding my hand when I feel pain or when I am lonely. Thank you also for the beautiful surroundings around me, especially rainbows and sunsets. I thank you for giving me the gift of my family and the wonderful people that support and encourage me. I thank you also for giving me a strong and wise spirit, and I know that I can and will go a long way with it, but not, of course, without you as my leaders, companions, and supporters. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Please, if there is something I can do to serve you, make it easy for me to do so. I am forever indebted to you. Love always, forever, Charlotte Jean. Thanking you in advance, I remain. Thanking God in advance for something not yet done is one of the highest forms of prayer. Implicit in such a prayer is the confidence that you are his child, and he would give you your heart's desire if only you tell him what you want. What father among you, it says in the Gospel of St. Luke, will give his son a snake if he asks for a fish, or hand him a scorpion if he asks for an egg? Humorist Mariana Nunez, a fellow member of the National Speakers Association, wrote such an anticipatory letter to God, thanking him for the husband she did not yet have. The letter was born out of the frustration of trying to meet a partner through the conventional means available to modern singles. She was an avid reader of the personals, answering what must be a record 74 ads in 2 years. There was so much activity on my 900 line, the phone company asked if I wanted a block on it. She got so good at dating, she designed a popular singles program, The Art of Flirting, which was featured in Life magazine. But still, she did not meet her match. Finally, her friend Bert gave her his advice about finding a mate. "Just give it up to the angels, Mariana," he told her, and gave her a cloth angel that she propped up on her windowsill as a reminder. Mariana went on lecturing all over the world in such exotic places as Bahrain and Kuwait, appearing on programs with the likes of Colin Powell, John Sununu, Marcia Clark, and Christopher Reeve. Something was missing in her life, though. She just wanted to, as she says, simply meet and marry a wonderful man. She kept answering personal ads, but was discouraged to find that the flattering, high-sounding hyperbole in the classifieds often did not match the reality once she agreed to date. So she was tickled to read one morning in her local California Burlingame Gazette a notice that was straightforward with no frills and made her hold her sides from laughter. "Breathing, has pulse, and can eat without assistance. If you chuckled, call." She liked this guy. She decided to call. Before dialing the number, Mariana went to fill her dog's water dish. That's when she discovered that Bert's angel had fallen into the sink. She picked up the angel and held it close. Surely this was a sign that the man of my dreams was on his way. The man who placed the funny ad was named Frederick. They talked on the phone, but never met. Another dead end. 8 months later, Mariana was on an airplane, coming back from one of her international presentations, feeling lonely. She grabbed a legal pad from her briefcase and wrote a letter to God describing the type of man she wanted. I wrote it in the present tense, and I was very specific. She wrote it as a prayer of thanksgiving. Dear God, I am very thankful for my husband. He is committed 100% to me, monogamous, spiritual, and we laugh so much together. He is my best friend and a wonderful lover. We have wonderful sex together, and we love each other deeply. We are so connected to each other mentally, spiritually, psychologically, socially, physically, and intellectually. We lead a balanced life together. We are successful and happy in our careers, and we love animals. We love and trust each other completely when we are apart. Our relationship is one of ease, playfulness. We communicate our differences easily to each other. We are sexually attracted to each other. We both want and plan to spend our lives together in marriage. Our families cherish each other. We travel together and celebrate holidays together. Thank you for my lifelong partner and best friend. Within a few days of her arrival home, the phone rang. It was Frederick. He had been cleaning his room and found my phone number behind his computer. We met and were engaged in 3 months, married 9 months later. That was 3 years ago. Today, Mariana and Frederick enjoy exactly the kind of marriage she was grateful for in advance. Wailing Wall. The idea of writing letters to God is no newfangled notion. In Jerusalem, near the Muslim Mosque of Omar, there is a 59-foot wall, believed to be a remnant of the Temple of Solomon from the 10th century B.C. In front of this wall, Jews gather on Fridays to lament and pray. Traditionally, they write messages to God, which they tuck into the crevices of the ancient holy rock. The power of these messages is so cherished that people often ask emissaries to place the notes in the wall for them. A woman I know named Carla did that. She and her husband, Mark, were not able to conceive. A group from the Christian church they attend was going to the holy city. Carla scratched a quick line, "I want a baby," on a scrap of paper, and asked the delegate to put it in the wailing wall. As Carla tells me this choice bit over the phone, I can hear her toddler playing happily in the background. We call Caden our miracle child. Writing letters to God. What a unique idea. And the good news is, you don't need a mailbox or a stamp. Now you. Write letters to God of praise and thanksgiving, or write to God at night, asking questions, or for guidance in decision-making. When you wake up in the morning, let the answer come to you through your pen. Sounds bizarre, but it can't hurt. Dear God, help me in this project. How can I feed my family? Do you like me, God? Am I doing the right thing? And by the way, have you seen the sweater I misplaced? You will be astonished at the answers, and you will find your sweater. 16. Resistance has meaning. When you find yourself hesitating before the next step in achievement of your goal, it's easy to blame the procrastination on an overworked schedule or on other people not cooperating. Guess what? It's you who is keeping you from completion. Let's find out why. Trina's story. I ran into my friend Trina by chance. She was waiting for a bus on a busy street when I drove past. I invited her to join me for coffee at Vivace's and offered to give her a ride home. Since we had not seen each other in almost 6 months, we had a lot of catching up to do. Trina is a vivacious, totally captivating young woman. She had recently returned from a trip to Ireland. With great merriment, she confided that she came back with a permanent souvenir, a butterfly charm dangling off a ring pierced into her belly button. As we talked, she began to tell me about a dream she had and the latest developments surrounding it. Then she showed me a post-it note, a plain yellow 2x2-inch piece of paper pressed into the front page of her engagement book, a simple patch with a history behind it. That square heralded an adventure waiting to take place, the first step in the fulfillment of a long-time aspiration. Trina filled me in on some background. She studied economics in college. From the first class, she was on fire with the possibilities it presented. She kept thinking that the practical application of economic principles could make a profound difference in the world. So she took another class and started reading every book she could get her hands on that had to do with economics. The more she read, the more certain she became that she wanted to help developing nations in a concrete way, but she did not have a clue where to start. How did she get from a bachelor's degree in business to developing economic policy? I didn't know what avenue I would take. I knew I didn't want to get into politics, and that discouraged me. I thought politics was the only way to break into policy making. When she heard that the Peace Corps used business majors, she went to a Peace Corps lecture, but it turned out that it wasn't right for her. It wasn't what she wanted to do. Teaching or being a doctor gives immediate help, but the real problem is money. The poorer countries of the world don't have any sort of sustainable economy. Once again, Trina was discouraged, thinking an organization that did what she wanted to do didn't exist. I had this big dream and no practical way of carrying it out, so I gave up on it. Meantime, Trina went about her life. Her current job was assistant coordinator for the Olympic Summer Music Festival, a 3-month program of chamber music started by the Philadelphia String Quartet. She enjoyed her work and liked being part of a non-profit arts organization that was making a vital contribution to the community. But, she admitted bluntly, it's okay to do this now, when I'm in my 20s. But after that, what? I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Trina also told me she had been volunteering at a place called Washington Works, an 8-week training program for welfare women to prepare them to get jobs. The course teaches them such things as secretarial skills, using a computer, handling the telephone, and then helps with placement. Trina acted as an advocate for women going through the program. When she signed up, they paired her with a woman with 3 children who was 26 years old. I felt as though I learned more from her than I helped her, because she was so incredibly brave. In addition to her job coordinating the music festival and her volunteer work, Trina also worked in an art gallery several evenings a week. One night recently, she told me, there were no customers or viewers in the gallery. She was all alone and bored. She picked up a stray newsletter and started reading it in a cursory way. It was just a random newsletter that showed up in the gallery mail, not something she would normally read. Her eyes fell on the People on the Move section, where there was a write-up about a local woman. The short piece highlighted the woman's recent appointment as Executive Director of Global Partnerships, an international nonprofit organization whose mission was to stimulate economies in third world countries using micro-lending. They set up village banks and arranged small-scale loans to indigent women to get them started in home-based businesses. Because of this program, instead of living in extreme poverty, the women were able to make enough money to feed their families, get education for their children, build up their supplies and marketing, and repay the loan with interest. Trina sat up straight when she read that. Her eyes opened wide as she tried to take in the impact of that description. For 3 years, I have read books on economics in my free time. From all the stuff I've read, small solutions are better than big ones. Using small steps, looking at what a country already has, and building on their strengths, is what works. And apparently, that is what Global Partnerships was doing. Low scale and local, rather than big changes, which later might fall apart. Even though all she knew about Global Partnerships at that point was no more than a few paragraphs in a throwaway newsletter, Trina could hardly contain her excitement. "Straight away," I said, "I want to get involved in this." That's when she wrote down the company, the phone number, the address, and the name of the new executive director on a post-it note. She thought she would call them, ask more about what they did, see if they could send her information, and ask them if she could get involved. Sounds simple and direct enough. It was perfect. Everything that I've wanted to do, what I imagined, without knowing such a thing as this existed. She slapped the sticky square into her daily planner. Every day, day after day, Trina looked at that post-it note staring her in the face. Each time she opened her time management book to plan her day, look up a phone number, or check an appointment, it beckoned to her, but she never did anything about it. Getting to the crux of it. It took a lot of resistance to ignore that reminder. Every day it challenged her, but she did not call. Why did she not call? When I asked her that question, Trina first excused herself. She was extremely busy at the gallery with the music festival and her volunteer work. The more we talked about it, though, the more she had to admit that being busy was not what was keeping her from dialing that number. With a sigh of resignation, she acknowledged that it was only herself stopping her. You know what it's like when you finally found just the right fit and you're scared to act on it because you worry, if I touch it, is it going to break? It is so hard to pick up the phone and call her, even though I want to talk to her so much. It is hard to do because it is exactly what I want. I asked Trina if she would be willing to write out her objections to get at what was underneath her inaction. I shared with her a principle I have taught for many years and believe in strongly. Resistance has meaning, and getting behind resistance, not just around it, will set you free. Right then and there, I invited her to take out her pen and a piece of paper, to write and keep writing, peeling away the layers until she got to the core of it. After an initial awkwardness, she was surprised at how quickly the words flowed. This is what she wrote. The people working for the executive director are probably all older than me and have tons of business background. Why would they want someone like me, someone who doesn't have much experience? I feel dumb calling and saying, "Wow, I want to hear more about what you do." I don't know what to say. I don't have that much training in economics. It's more of a gut feeling and an instinct. The big thing is I feel like I can't talk intelligently about what it is that I want to do. And then Trina remembered when she was in Ireland, how she went home with an Irish family for Christmas. She rode back from Clare to Dublin, 3 hours in the car with her friend Michael and his older brother Adrian, who had majored in economics. When I told Adrian how great it was that he majored in economics, and how I had wanted to major in economics and work on the economy in developing nations, he went off, saying, "I don't know who you think you are, you Americans. You think that you can go to the third world and change things around when they were just fine to begin with." All the way to Dublin, he was berating me. He would not let me get a word in edgewise. He was too busy telling me why everything I thought was wrong. In writing it out, Trina realized how much the shadow of Adrian's comments still hung over her, and how she had internalized them into her own self-doubts. What was I going to say to her? She would think that I was a crazy young, gushing girl who didn't know what she was talking about. Trina had a smile on her face when she finished writing. It suddenly all made sense. It felt good just to know. When you are honest, shackles drop. She felt lighthearted, as though she were putting down a heavy burden that she had been carrying on her back for a long time. Once you identify the meaning behind your resistance, the block disintegrates, leaving you wide open for fulfillment. When you own the life you live, you open the way to claim the life you want. Less than a week after we met, Trina walked into a cocktail party honoring local dignitaries and the volunteers at Washington Works. She started talking to a woman she knew from her committee, who, in turn, was talking to another woman. Trina introduced herself to the other woman and asked her where she was from. The woman smiled back at her and said, "Well, I just got a new job. I'm the executive director of Global Partnerships, a nonprofit organization." Trina wasted no time in offering her services to help in any way possible. Trina never stopped studying, never gave up her dream to make a worldwide difference through economic principles, to help impoverished people to live decent lives, to rid the world of hunger. A scary phone call almost stopped her, until she faced foursquare the meaning behind her resistance. Then the world was free to help her along a little. Now you. Resistance has meaning. It is an adage worth highlighting. What in your life are you resisting? Where are you digging your heels in? Write down the reasons behind your reluctance. What is it about moving forward does not seem safe? You may think it is because of forces outside of you. Pressures at work, a bank account low on funds, an unsupportive parent or partner. Go ahead. Blame it on someone else and something else. Start with that to get it out of your system. And then keep writing until you come to the truth. What is it about you that resists taking this next step? The truth shall set you free, and free the world to help you along a little. 17. Creating a ritual. When you attach your writing to a ceremony, it becomes somewhat sacred. Ritual recognizes something larger than yourself as part of the plan. Adding ritual to the writing of your goals makes the message more meaningful. It sets something in motion. Elaine's story. Elaine St. James is the author of a popular series of simplicity books, including Simplify Your Life and Inner Simplicity. Having written a book a year for 4 years straight, she was ready to present her ideas to audiences through professional speaking, quite an accomplishment for a woman who did not, until recently, consider herself a writer, and once had a fear of public speaking. A mutual friend gave her my name, and she called me for advice on marketing and managing speaking engagements. We hit it off right away, and soon found ourselves chatting long distance like sisters separated at birth and now reunited. Elaine exudes warmth and friendliness, and punctuates her narratives with light-hearted laughter. She seems amazed at her own success, and is clearly convinced that anyone could do what she did. I don't remember how we got on the topic, but when Elaine started talking about a ceremony she and a friend engage in every New Year's Eve, my ears perked up. By the time she finished explaining the details, my heart was pounding, and I was determined to put it into practice myself. The Arrow Ceremony. Here's how it started. Elaine and her friend meet every year for a New Year's goal setting. About 10 years ago, the friend heard about an interesting custom, and they thought they would try it. Elaine has been doing it every year since. It goes like this. In many Native American cultures, tribes and families would gather to start up a new year at the solstice and have a special celebration, where they would make a request to the Great Spirit to eliminate certain things that they no longer wanted in their lives, and to bring in things that they now wanted to have in their lives. As a way of representing this, they would craft 6 arrows, 3 to represent the things they did not want, and 3 for the things that they did want. The preparation was as important as the ceremony itself. They would lovingly carve these special arrows, using bird feathers for the ends of the arrows. They called them death arrows and life arrows, because they held, respectively, the things they wanted to be dead and out of their lives, and those they wanted to bring life to. The death arrows were put in low ground, in a circle inscribed with tobacco leaves. One by one, they would each step into the circle from the north, put the arrows in the ground, and say certain silent prayers, concentrating on that which they were willing to give up, or what they wanted to be rid of. Once everybody had done that, they would burn those arrows. The smoke would send a signal to the Great Spirit. Then they would go to higher ground, inscribing a similar circle, this time leaving the opening to the south. Again, one by one, they would go into the new circle and put the arrows in the ground, and make the request to the Great Spirit for what they wanted to bring into their lives. They would leave those arrows standing for the Great Spirit throughout the year. According to Elaine's friend, it was supposed to be magical, absolute magic. What you requested to be taken out of your life would be removed, and what you wanted to come in came in. The Indians had unswerving faith that what they asked for would be granted if they went through this ceremony. Southern California Ecological Version. Elaine and her friend adapted the Native American tradition to their own circumstances. We did not know how to make arrows, so the first year we went out and got sticks, willow branches, and tied ribbons to the ends to represent the feathers. My friend, her two daughters, and I cut six little strips of paper for each of what we called the good arrows and the bad arrows. We wrote up our intentions and then scotch-taped them to the willow branch. Elaine remembers that they all, including the children, took the preparation very seriously. They thought hard about the question, what do we want in our lives and out of our lives? They wrote out the answers purposefully and taped them carefully to the willow branches. They had the attitude, it works for the Native Americans, it's going to work for us. The plan was to get up early the next morning, because the custom was to do this ceremony before sunrise. Elaine and her friend were not scrupulous about that part. My friend and I got up before dawn as promised, but it was such a circus getting these young girls, ages 13 and 16, up, even though they really got into it the night before. They were totally committed, but when it came time to get up in the morning, they were tired after staying up late doing all this readiness. So we said, oh well, the Great Spirit will understand an extra hour. We finally got them going. Everyone bundled up because it was cold, and we piled in the car and went up into the hills. We found a spot that looked right, and we got out of the car and climbed over a fence. We were probably trespassing. Elaine had purchased an expensive brand of tobacco, and they broke it up and created a round trail of brown leaves. After we inscribed the circle, we went inside it and said out loud to the Great Spirit what we wanted out of our lives. Elaine counted on the Great Spirit to make allowances for Southern Californian environmental concerns and fire regulations, as well as sleepy teenagers. Rather than burning those arrows, we buried them, because we live in a fire zone where there is a burn ban. We figured instead of seeing the smoke, the Great Spirit would hear our requests, since we said them out loud. Then they got in the car and drove to higher ground, and did the same thing, with the circle opened to the south this time. We went into the circle and made our requests. Rather than leave these petitions standing, where someone might find them, we buried them discreetly. We figured that the Spirit could find them and grant them either way. Over the years, the practice evolved as Elaine made personal adjustments to the rite. For every year after that, I got a box of number 2 pencils. It was easier than locating enough willow branches, and arrows are hard to come by. Also, the sharpened ends went easily into the ground. She continued to use colorful ribbons in place of feathers, making a special trip to the fabric store to get real ribbon. The ribbons were 5 to 6 inches long, about as long as the pencil, and we put them together with a piece of tape at the eraser end of the pencil, bright-colored strips of ribbon coming out of the end of the pencil, black ribbon for the death arrows, and red, yellow, green, and blue for the life arrows. Important enough to pay attention to. Putting your petitions on paper imprints them on your subconscious. Elaine says, if it was important enough for you to make a request, it is important enough to pay attention to. The ritual is profound because of everything involved in doing it. Any ritual can be profound in that way. To me, it was a new observance, so I really got into it. One of the reasons this particular technique is powerful is because there are so many steps involved, so many things that you have to do to energize your petitions. These steps are important because in performing these steps, you send a message to your subconscious that says, I am taking this seriously. Even the night before, preparing becomes a serious message to your subconscious. Quantum leap. Elaine often copies her major requests in her journal in addition to the pre-dawn burial. I don't know if the others do this, but I frequently write down what my arrows are when I come back after the ceremony. Sometimes the petitions read like a prayer. For the first couple of years, we just wrote single sentences. They got deeper and deeper as we went on. As we saw how effective they were, we got more and more and more serious, at least I did, about constructing what I wanted. Elaine is often amazed when she goes back and revisits those journal pages a year or so later and realizes that it happened without my realizing it had happened. One year, Elaine wrote an arrow asking for guidance, for a quantum leap in financial and personal arenas, and the way to make a difference in other people's lives. I went on and forgot about this arrow. It wasn't until several years later that I looked back and thought, breathlessly, "Wow! Look at all that happened because I made that arrow. I did not have a clue what I was asking for. I just knew I wanted to take a giant step forward in my personal and professional life." She is astonished now to reread this life arrow from over 10 years ago. Great spirit. I would like guidance in stepping on to a new plateau of personal and financial growth and achievement. I want to make a great step forward in terms of what I will accomplish with my life from this point onward. In a quiet, understated way, I want to be able to make a difference in people's lives and to make a positive contribution to the world. I am just entering into the main stretch. Please help me to expand exponentially in all areas of my life. That was January 1988. That spring, Elaine got the idea to write a real estate book. She had not ever thought about writing a book before. She figured out how to write a proposal, figured out how to find an agent, got a publisher, started writing the book, and then submitted the manuscript. The book was a smash hit. CNN, the works. And then I found out that Viking, the publisher, was going to send me on a tremendous tour. There was one problem. She was terrified of public speaking, and always had been. I had always said to the universe, "Give me a reason to get over this fear, and I will." Now here was the reason. I had to get over my fear of public speaking in order to do the promotion. So she enrolled in Toastmasters, a club where members learn speaking skills, and she went on tour, in spite of her high anxiety. Soon, she wasn't so scared anymore. The more she did it, the less it frightened her. As Elaine sees it now, that was the beginning step of a whole new propellant toward personal, financial, and inner achievement. It took several years, but she looks back and sees how it started there. It was because of the success of the first book that she realized how complex her life was and became determined to simplify it. I got back from the tour and looked at my time management system, which was the size of Nebraska. It was huge. I said, "This is crazy." My life was complicated. I had the book to promote. I had my own real estate investment portfolio to manage. And I had started seminars teaching agents how to do this real estate investing technique. All of that coming together the way it did forced me to simplify, and it was out of simplifying that I wrote Simplify Your Life and the books that followed on the same theme. Out of that, I became a writer. Her first book was on equity sharing. Being a writer was the furthest thing from her mind. I only wrote the real estate book because there wasn't one out there, and I figured it would be a helpful technique. I wasn't thinking of myself as a writer. I was writing as an investor. And when I wrote Simplify Your Life, I wrote it because so many people were asking me, coming up to me and saying, "I hear you've simplified your life. You got rid of the big house. You got rid of all your stuff. I need to do that. How did you do it? What did you do?" Elaine made a pledge to herself that she would not do anything she did not enjoy. The idea came to write the Simplicity book, and I thought I would enjoy that. So I did it. The next book came as naturally. When I was on Oprah, Oprah said to me, "Elaine, what do you do with all this time?" And that's how Inner Simplicity came about. It wasn't until I was writing Inner Simplicity, by now my third book, that I started getting letters from people who said my second book had changed their lives. I was thrilled by the letters I got and the people I heard from. Then it finally occurred to me, hey, I could be a writer. 3 more Simplicity books followed. More than 1 million copies of these books have sold so far and have certainly made a profound difference in people's lives in a quiet, understated way. I am absolutely convinced, it is clear to me, that it all came out of that life arrow with its prayer to the Great Spirit to guide my life. Out of that, it was writing a book. It was simplifying. It was getting over my fear of public speaking. It was getting into inner realms that I had not even thought about at that point. There is no question in my mind that it happened because I made that declaration. And there is no question in her mind that anyone could do what she did. It's the motive that matters. I first heard about Elaine St. James's Arrow tradition in February, a few days before my birthday. So, as a birthday gift to me, my cohorts in crime, Dorothy and Bill, offered to go through the ceremony with me. As part of the preparation, Dorothy cooked a special meal of fresh trout, rice with cranberries, and a terrific dessert of lemon ginger snaps. We spent a long time devising the pencils. We got into a heated discussion of whether the ribbon feathers should go straight up or sideways like little flags. We finally opted for the flag style because it was easier to attach, but I admit I was worried if that was correct. We put all the black, beribboned pencils in one paper sack and the multicolored ones in another, lest we grab and bury the wrong ones in the dark. Before retiring, we packed up a flashlight, a small trowel, a butane flamethrower, and a compass on a red rope. On our way to the marina at dawn the next morning, we realized we did not have tobacco, so we stopped at an all-night convenience store. None of us had smoked since college days, so it felt funny buying Camels. But I was worried that filter-tipped Salems were not authentic enough. We started to fret. There was the beginning of light in the sky. Were we past pre-dawn? Bill assured us that sunrise was at 7:10 a.m., and we still had plenty of time. Then we worried again about the cigarettes. Were even Camels strong enough? Or would it have been better to purchase Durham loose tobacco? When we got to the beach, we carefully inscribed a circle on the rocky sand near the water with an opening to the south, and one by one, we buried the death arrows with their notations of the things we wanted to get rid of in our lives. Then we turned around, climbed over the railroad tracks, and hiked high up the side of the hill, where we made a tobacco-laced circle with the opening to the north, and burned with pomp and circumstance the life arrows, inscribed with our highest aspirations. We stood a moment silently, and then suddenly a train came rushing out of the darkness along the tracks. The unexpected power of it rooted us to the ground to keep our balance and blew our hair back. It seemed like a good, solid sign. When we came down off the mountaintop, we went to Starbucks to debrief. The sun was just starting to come up. Over steaming mugs of Yukon blend, we checked my notes from Elaine and found out, to our horror, we had it all backward. The opening on the lower ground is supposed to point north, and the upper ground points south. In addition, we were meant to burn the former and bury the latter. Oh no! Now we were inviting into our lives all the things we wanted to be liberated from, and scattering to the winds the very things we wanted an abundance of. We groaned over our coffee and wondered what to do. When I arrived home, it was my young daughter Catherine, wiser than her years, who put my heart at ease. She dismissed all my concerns as inconsequential. "It's the motive that matters, not the particulars," she told me. How right she was. Catherine's comment reassured me, and then made me smile. One of my black arrows had listed a trait I wanted to dispense